Now, 12:712, the work session for the Page County Board of Supervisors is hereby called to order. Before I get started tonight, we would like to thank everyone for coming. This tonight is an informational meeting for everyone, all right, for the citizens of the county and for the board also. Before we go on, I know it's a little cramped, I like to get that some good choice of words. If everybody's standing around the wall or you're seated, can you see the screen that will be presented over here? Okay, can everybody see pretty good? All right, we'd also like to welcome the newspapers here tonight. We'd also like to welcome WHSB TV3 from Hershenburg that's here tonight. And along tonight, the topic, number one, can you hear me? Can everybody hear me good? Okay. Very good. Turn it up.
Turn it up.
You make me speak closer or just turn it up?
Not this.
That's better.
All right. Yeah, I get that deep voice.
All right. Makes me sound important. All right. Tonight we're going to hear a presentation from the FiberWatt Corporation, which is considering Page County at this point as a potential site. Notice I say considering because no decisions of any kind has been made definite for this corporation to come here. This is an information meeting for the citizens of Page County and for the board to bring everyone up to date as to what's been happening in the last 8 months. All right, as you know, tonight we've asked the county citizens to present their questions that you would have because this is not a citizen comment time. Because we're not to that stage, that's why we're not allowing that tonight. And I say we, I mean the board. Now, with those questions that come in, and I'd like to thank each and every person that sent them to me. And if you want to know what happened to them, I have them right here in my briefcase, so they did not get thrown away. I do have them. And I have every correspondence that's been sent on this particular topic. And tonight, what's been happening, we took all the questions, we consolidated them down because, as you know, a lot of them is repetition. The questions were repeated. They were threw down into a paper of 83 questions, okay? Because, like again, a lot of them is repetition. This was on the table as you for you to get as you came in. If anyone didn't receive a copy of these questions, then you check with the county administrator's office tomorrow. We can make copies of those. Make sure you get a copy of those questions at that point if for some reason you didn't get it tonight. Tonight, as we go through this presentation, I'm going to introduce the people that's here. But I'd also like for you to give them Page County welcome. And that, I'm saying that as a big welcome because I know Page County is good at that. Also, I'd like for you to give them your respect. And that respect tonight is to be in the form, if you have a question of some kind after the meeting is over or some kind of comment you would like to say to one of us six that's up here, you know, you're welcome to do that. But please do it in an adult manner without using unnecessary words or unnecessary gestures, which I know you don't do, and because I know Page County people, and you are good-hearted people. And we appreciate that from the word go, and we expect that respect to be given tonight. Tonight, we'd like to welcome from FiberWatt, the gentleman that's standing here at the mic, is Mr. Terrence Longsley. He is the Vice President of the Environmental and Public Affairs of FiberWatt. In the back corner, and I guess I'll get him to stand up, Mr. Eric Jenkins. There he is right here. He's the Vice President of Commercial Development for FiberWatt. Also, the gentleman on the front row, which is up here in the square, this is Mr. Greg Thornton. He's a Community Liaison Director for FiberWatt. And then in the back, also, we have privilege with us tonight is Mr. Stephen Versen. He is with the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. This is the gentleman right here.
Hey,
as we go through here tonight, we're going to do the presentation here, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Walker here in just a few minutes. We will proceed to listen and to hear their information. As we go through the program here tonight, I'm going to check off the questions that have been answered in this presentation. At the end, if you would happen to overlook one of some type, then I'll ask that question, or one of the board members will ask that question at the end. And if we have any other question we want to ask, these six members here are the ones that ask the questions at that point. Again, thank you all for coming. And Mr. Monkley, I'll turn it over to you to get started at this point.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the board, and I'd like to thank the community here in Page County. This is a change. This is different. This is something that is being looked at as a way of benefiting Page County, benefiting the poultry industry, benefiting the environment through renewable energy, and benefiting overall an economy that at this point, in many places that year, is struggling. Fibrobots can be known by many things, but I think if you were to look on the internet and get a capsule look at what Fibrobot is, basically power of the poultry litter. What I'd like to do today, since we're kind of new, certainly here, new to the community, new to the board, is go through what are the very typical, very basic questions: who, what, where, when, and why. And as you had indicated, with the long 83 questions, I'll do the best to try to address as many as I can. Quite frankly, this is very early in our development process, so where I can, I'll try to address some. Some will be, frankly, unknown at this point. And to give a little bit more guidance, I'll try to use examples of other projects that we've worked on, specifically our Minnesota project. And we are currently in the process, a little further along, developing projects in North Carolina. So what I'd like to do as part of this is talk a little bit, first off, of who Fibrobot is. Give a little bit of history, talk a little bit of how this came into existence, why it was considered important and continues to be considered important. Also, spend some time talking about what is power from poultry litter. I expect, through some of the contact we've had to date, you gather it's basically taking poultry litter, excess poultry litter, and converting it into useful energy and indirectly retaining a lot of its nutrient value for future use. Indirectly, I'll go over a few of the key components. As I said, we're very early in the development process. We have not chosen sites, and in many respects, we're just beginning our site evaluation. So to give you kind of an overview of how we view an opportunity, we do view Virginia as a very important opportunity for Fibrobot, based on the longstanding history of the poultry industry in the state, and specifically in the Shenandoah Valley. To help give a better understanding of where we are right now and where this process would go, spend a little bit of time talking about the basic components of the development process. And then I think it's also very important to try to highlight needs and benefits of a project like this. Where I can, as you see in the bottom, I'll try to deal with the general questions. We've been through this before in multiple projects, and I do not expect in a forum like this or at this stage in development that one wouldn't expect to have a lot of questions. And I value the opportunity that you've provided to ask those questions and give us an opportunity to get into a little bit more detail. Does that mean everything I say will lead to agreement throughout the county? I suspect not. But as you had said, we'll try to do it in a way that will present as much information in useful ways as we can. So who is Fibrobot? Fibrobot is a developer, a builder and operator of renewable energy plants, specifically concentrating on poultry litter as its primary fuel. These would be characterized as renewable energy plants because they are taking a natural material, naturally environmentally available carbon, producing energy, in this case electricity, and recovering the nutrients. Different than fossil fuel combustion such as coal, natural gas, or oil, what it's doing is circulating or recycling the carbon that's already in the environment. Comparing that to coal, one of the reasons why renewables are so important in this day and age is, unlike renewables, fossil fuels are taking carbon that are in the ground, and as we all know, one of the key points of emphasis right now is global climate change, greenhouse gases, and trying to find a balance around our generation of much needed electricity in the context of environmental issues. We specialize in poultry litter. We really specialize in agricultural materials. While our predominant fuel will be poultry litter, and we site and locate plants in areas with high poultry production, that is not the only material we use. We also will augment it with other types of secondary biomass, generally some form of forestry or agricultural biomass that will be used not only to supplement our fuel, but also to acknowledge the fact that poultry litter is produced according to the birds and according to the growers' production cycle, and we have to be available to manage their needs year-round, week to week, month to month, year to year, and to do that we supplement with other forms of secondary biomass. I will get into that a little further in the tail end. A very important component of this is not just renewable energy, it's also nutrient management. One of the things that makes a solution like this attractive in a high area of poultry production is that we can help absorb excess litter. We're not going to use all the litter, but we'll absorb excess litter and help establish, in many respects, a better balance of managing nutrients, and in doing so, also produce renewable energy. You can view us as a service to the poultry industry, and obviously, here in Page County and the Valley in general, this is a place of very concentrated, very successful poultry production. What we can do is help that industry be sustainable by managing excess litter, and as I get into the presentation a little bit, I'll explain what I mean by excess litter, because regardless of where it's made, because of its basic composition, you are going to have excess amounts of litter in most concentrated poultry areas. To give you a little bit of background, FiberWatt has been in existence as an entity since the late 80s. It was founded in 1988 in the UK. The founder, Simon Fraser, dealt with through a Scotch distillery, trying to find other alternative fuels than fossil fuels. Through a lot of testing, through a lot of evaluation, he ultimately came to poultry litter as not only material that could make electricity in a very cost-effective fashion, but could actually add an additional benefit by properly taking care of excess poultry litter. So it's not just the production of electricity is also the environmental benefits that are created by managing it in a different way. FiberWatt built the very first three poultry litter fire power plants. They're built in various locations within the UK. Ultimately, as we'll talk about a little further, there are limits to how many plants you can build based on using the excess litter, a portion of all the litter that's generated. At a point where they had done much of what could be done in the UK, started to investigate the United States as a possibility. The US obviously is a substantially bigger poultry growing area. At the time they were investigating this, they were contacted in much the same way we've been contacted around the country by poultry growers and the poultry industry, recognizing that they had to plan for their sustainability, the long-term ability to produce birds in a concentrated area. We were contacted by a third-generation turkey farmer who said, I'm dealing right now with growing regulation at the state level. I have to deal with issues like nuisance on local residents, dealing with growing regulation on how quickly I have to manage my litter. I need options, because right now I have a single option, land application. So we were brought into Minnesota. I'll describe a little bit about what has happened in Minnesota, the history that we have in Minnesota. And we ultimately, through much, a very similar process, we had ultimately 30 different communities that recognized that this was a solution that could help sustain what they existed on economically, which was agriculture. In Minnesota, a vast majority in many of the counties where they raise birds is dependent not only on the birds for its economic health, but also for the crops that ultimately become the feed that go into providing the feedstuff for the individual poultry farms. They took a very proactive look. They recognized that this is a way not only to manage this growing burden of poultry litter, but also to help them sustain their economy. I suspect much in the same way Page County is looking at this as an opportunity to do the same. We now are based, and are a U.S. company, we're based in Pennsylvania. Our parent company is Homeland Renewable Energy, and they're located up in New England, New Hampshire. Homeland Renewable Energy is, I guess, in charter, been put together first off to provide the expertise in financing and financial management for FiberWatt, but to look at other opportunities. The issues with manure management is not something that's unique to this area. It's required, it's needed in many parts. They've also recognized that there are other fuels, much like poultry litter, woody biomass, other agricultural materials that can also be utilized for energy production. So they are what would be considered our holding company, our parent company. FiberWatt is a subsidiary of Homeland Renewable Energy. Just real quickly to kind of give you a scale of how things have progressed. In the UK, the very first plant is the iPower station. It was built actually on a World War II RAF base. It was built by and large to deal with the fact that much like you're seeing here in the United States, the success of the poultry industry was creating a challenge on how to manage poultry litter. It's a modest-sized plant, 12.7 megawatts. But what it did is it gave FiberWatt the first opportunity to try technology. Poultry litter is not an easy deal. It certainly is not an easy deal. It took a lot of trial and error, and it took multiple plants to where we could get a plant to run consistently and be able to serve the area. This plant, which has been up in operation since 1992, continues to be in operation. So it has a very long track record of being able to meet the needs of the local poultry industry, even though it's at a relatively small size. This was followed at about the same time by the Blanford Station. The Blanford Station is 13.5 megawatts. Why two small plants at the same time? As part of the effort to promote renewables in the UK, they were looking for technology demonstrations. So we were able to build another plant similar in scale but using different technology. And from that, we were able to arrive at our third plant. I should be careful when I say our third plant. At the time, FiberWatt began as FiberWatt Limited in the UK. Right now, FiberWatt is solely a US company, and the assets of FiberWatt Limited are now under the control of a large Australian bank. So when I talk about FiberWatt, I'm really talking about FiberWatt here in the United States, but you can't avoid the fact that we have experience that goes back all the way to 92 with operations. The Deptford Power Plant was commissioned in 1998. It allowed FiberWatt to look at those two plants, readapt the technology, and in an interesting way, when FiberWatt in the UK first began development, the poultry industry was a little skeptical. They weren't initially interested in committing to this because it was unproven technology. What we found after the plant began operation, it demonstrated its ability to operate for a significant period of time, that the poultry industry recognized all the benefits of a plant like this and quite frankly said, you know, we have a lot more litter than we originally indicated. We would like you to commit to a third plan that can help us meet the growing need for other options than land application. As I indicated, after the UK had, in many respects, kind of met the capacity for poultry, or power for poultry litter, the founders were brought over to the United States by interest. In each case where we've gone, much like here in Page County, we've gone where the solution came to be recognized as valuable, and we were welcomed into a community to consider it. In many cases with economic development, you'll have a particular project that will come into existence, and before communities have an opportunity to fully consider it, to be rather public with the natural questions that are going to come up, a site has been chosen, and the community in some cases may become a bit disenfranchised. What we have found is the most appropriate thing, since we're going to be a long-term potential neighbor, a part of the community, is to make sure that we develop a project, not necessarily one that everyone buys into, but one that everyone has had an opportunity to understand, comment, and question, and get a better feel. Frankly, we learn a lot from it. Our plans in each case have been responsive to the community. In the UK as well as Minnesota, we have instigated very early in the process a citizens advisory panel, some kind of a community outreach effort that the local community could participate in a very meaningful way. As we went from that initial siting through the permitting, through the financing, construction, and ultimately operation. Just to use the kind of case in point, in our plant up in Minnesota, we've had an operating citizens advisory panel since the very beginning of 2001, and there are a number of members that are on that panel that have been associated with it for the entire time, basically 10 years. It's something that we believe in and we want to be out there giving people an opportunity to both learn about it, but also have an opportunity to ask questions. As you'll note, the Minnesota plant is larger than the first three in the UK. Why is it larger? Well, as I said, the US poultry litter or poultry market is far bigger in each case. It's also bigger because one of the key criteria when we develop a project is we need to be responsive to the local utilities that ultimately will buy the electricity that will be dependent on having a long-term agreement. But we'll also have to do it in such a way that meets the need in the area and meets, you know, an opportunity to allow, frankly, the poultry industry to grow in many cases. So there's a lot that goes into deciding on the size. In this area, we have an idea as a base that we're probably in the 40 megawatt area. But a lot of that will depend on the amount of litter that we can enter into some form of an agreement. It will depend on the utility's interest in participating in a power purchase agreement. And it'll also ultimately depend on where we're located and where transmission lines and the grid has the capability of dealing with this particular amount of power. As I said, the Minnesota plant's been up and operating now for about 2.5 years. Anyone that has spent a little bit of time on the internet will notice we had some challenges very early in the operation of that plant. What we did in this location is, like we've done in each case, improve the technology. We improved the emission control equipment on the back end. We improved the way we manage litter within the plant. And we went through the hiccups and challenges of starting up a plant. I think what you'll see, and having spent some time looking at the challenges we went through, is that we are a very well-controlled facility that has proper oversight from the regulatory bodies, because what we do is so visible through continuous emission monitors, through stack tests, and a number of ways that they keep tabs on our operations. The Minnesota plant is designed to manage anywhere from 500 to 700,000 tons per year of biomass. Why do I say a range? Frankly, if you go to a poultry farm, you do the testing, you'll come to realize that every farm manages their birds in a different way. As a consequence, some litter will be wet, some will be dry. Likewise, depending on how much other material we use, like woody biomass, or up in Minnesota, we use sunflower hulls, corn stover, corn stalks. When you put all that in a balance, it'll have the capability of generating 55 megawatts in Minnesota, but it has the ability to adjust to the fluctuation in fuel quality. And it's something that we have to be able to do is meet the needs of the growers. Why is this so important? Well, if you know anything about meat consumption in the United States, poultry was a very minimal meat of choice. It has now become the number one meat of choice. Why? In many respects, because of the ability to do it in the scale they do it. The fact that you can raise the birds in areas confined, yet still operating much in the same way they would do as a flock. You can do it in such a way that of all the meat products is probably the most environmentally prudent way of raising meat products. And it can do it in a way that constantly meets the need of the appetite for meat in the area where it's generated, as well as its ability to move it around the United States and frankly exporting material. Just to kind of give you an idea of what the poultry industry is to Virginia. In 2008, and I think, you know, in some respects, it's sometimes very hard to put the emphasis on what a project, and I'll hit this up front, put the emphasis on how important this can be to not just the poultry industry, but agriculture in general. I think in many cases, the importance of providing our own food from this country can't be emphasized enough. And I think in many cases, it's overlooked how important our agricultural economy is to the United States in general. We found in wherever we've gone, in many of the urban, suburban areas, very few people really realize the challenges that a farmer or grower will have in managing the various issues they have to deal with. Waterway protection, manure management, obtaining feed, dealing with the relationships they have on selling their product. And what this will do, frankly, is provide a greater emphasis on how they can remain a sustainable part of our economy, but also the local economy. As I said, in the state of Virginia, 10,000 people are directly employed by poultry. In and around the state as a whole, there are about 1,200 poultry farms. The most concentrated area of poultry rearing is here in Shenandoah Valley, in this particular region. It's also an extremely important part of the Virginia economy. Represents almost $1 billion in revenue a year. Pretty significant. It also represents one of the historically most successful areas in the country for raising poultry. Virginia, and while not included, West Virginia ends up being a very substantial poultry growing area. It's approximately, and this is just as Virginia, ninth overall in broiler chicken production, and fifth overall in turkey production. So you have a very sizable and very somewhat vulnerable, because you have constraints associated with being in a valley, and the ability of the industry to both operate sustainably and grow in many respects at this point is hindered by managing the nutrients, managing litter on a long-term basis. I think most importantly with this slide, and why an alternative solution becomes so important, is you have to recognize, and you've probably seen it, for people that, and frankly, I'm not sure of the assets that are in this area, but if you were to go to a location where they produce the feed for the poultry farms, you'd realize they're bringing them in. They're bringing corn, soybean in extremely long trains that are very similar in size to a coal plant, 100 unit trains. There is an incredible incredible amount of nutrients that are coming from the Midwest, where a lot of this heat will come. It's coming into this area and has very few opportunities to escape this area, other obviously than in the poultry itself. So what this ends up being is a pretty significant sink for nutrients with very few opportunities to provide an option to manage those nutrients in a different way. So what is poultry litter? I think most people know what it is. It's poultry manure. It's a bedding material that's quite often wood shavings, sawdust. Up in Minnesota, it's sunflower hulls. In some parts of the country, it's peanut shells. It's basically a material that allows the bird to live in the poultry barn much in the same way it would be outside of the poultry barn on the bedding material. In general, they'll mow the barn up with a couple truckloads of this material, 3-4 inches high. By the time the birds have gone through the usually multiple flocks before the litter is generated, it will end up being about roughly 90% manure and about 10% bedding material. When we bring the litter to our facility, it does contain other materials. It contains often these barns are located on dirt clay floors, so we'll bring some of that material in. It'll also have excess water associated with problems with the drinker system. It'll have excess or waste feed. And on occasion, it'll have other trace materials like tools, coke cans, bricks, things that can be found in normal poultry farms. Now, when we look at it and bring it into our plant, we see two things in it. Right now, it has a single use as a nutrient source. We look at it as not only a nutrient source, but also a fuel source. So we're valuing, looking at the poultry litter, recognizing its fuel value, and also the fact that it will have residual nutrient content. How is it managed right now? Basically, if you go by most of the poultry farms, they'll periodically scrape off a portion of it, they'll store it in a dry stack farm, and then over time, they'll use it on land. They have very few options. They'll use it on the land basically pre-planting and post-harvest. So either you plan your clean out of the barn according to that, or you are going to be managing material outside the barn in some kind of storage, either an open stockpile, though I think in this area it's dominated by covered storage. Spread on the local fields. One thing we've also found in spending quite a bit of time analyzing litter that it has a rather variable nutrient content, depending where you take it out of the barn. We've done barn testing, both of quantity and quality. And as you look at the fuel, in our case fuel, as you look at the litter as it comes out of the barns, some will be very wet, some will be very dry, some will have higher nutrients than other. One of the challenges is trying to deal with poultry litter from the expectation that it is a balanced fertilizer. First off, it's a very low nutrient quality fertilizer, typically 3% nitrogen, 3% phosphorus, 2% potassium. The rest is either moisture or other materials, but it's also very hard to apply according to the nutrient content. What we offer is an opportunity for the poultry grower to manage their poultry litter in another way by taking what they would define as excess litter and send it in a different direction. So what is the FiberWatt solution? Basically, the FiberWatt solution is a companion to poultry farming. It's a companion to poultry farming through renewable energy. What we are doing, as I said, is taking advantage of its fuel value and the residual ash fertilizer byproduct that comes from it. Our fuel producers, I don't know per se how big the farms are here, but I will use Minnesota as an example. There are some farms that We'll manage as many as a million turkey on a single farm in a single year. They have barns that are a quarter of a mile long. In doing that, manure management or litter management is quite a challenge and quite a task. In general, it'd be hard to say how much is generated, but we did some basic litter testing out of Minnesota, and we found in a very standard turkey barn that they're producing upwards of 700 to 800 tons per barn per year. So that's a highly concentrated generation of litter and generation of nutrients. As part of our process, we recognize that we're not going to be successful unless we understand the poultry industry. We can provide them benefits, we can provide them service. So it all starts with us coordinating our efforts with the poultry farm. We'll deal with the poultry farm on scheduling. As I'll show, we supply the transportation for the poultry farm. We do whatever the poultry farm places value on. Frankly, they want to raise the birds. Litter management is, in many cases, a challenge. To get it from the barn to a potential user can be quite a challenge. So what we do is we provide a means for them to deal with it year-round according to their schedule, deal with it quickly, since we'll work with procurement of the trucks, having the number of trucks they need and how quickly. And also, it allows them to take a little bit more control. Right now, they have to operate according to crop application. Do it in the spring, do it in the fall, and at that same time, they're competing with others to get it on the farm. They're competing for replacement bedding material. What this does is gives, like most businesses want, an option, a second option. We'll work with the poultry farm. In many cases right now, unlike in Minnesota, we've seen, I'll use North Carolina as an example, and we have a little more experience with our grower outreach. They value more than what Minnesota values. So in North Carolina, and I suspect here, not only are we supplying the transportation service, but we'll work with them to provide the barn cleanout service. We may be supplying them as needed a bedding material, trying to be a full service provider to the particular grower. To do this and do it successfully and quickly, we have to be very conscious of their biosecurity needs. What is biosecurity? It's basically managing litter in a way that will protect the health of the birds on the farm. So we'll set up approaches, use equipment that will make it easy, protect their biosecurity, and get it into trucks. Our truck transportation will be in normal 18-wheel trucks. We're trying to minimize the number of trucks on the road. In many cases, if you look at the amount of transfer and transport litter right now, it's on the road. It's already on the road, and in most cases, it's not on the road in equipment that's maximizing the payload, but also maximizing the protection to the area that these trucks are going through. We take a lot of attention to the poultry industry's needs, but we do it also for, you know, proper acknowledgement of the community impact of moving poultry litter from one location to another. We'll load the trucks. It often will be done very quickly. It allows the grower to stay in the barn or the cleanout company to stay in the barn. It will be transferred by what's called a litter conveyor, litter loader. It isn't used in all cases. What we'll do is we'll need how the grower does it, how the grower wants to do it. But we try to do it in such a way that will minimize the time that we're impacting their operation. We'll also do it with tightly covered trucks. We have a very good track record, not only in the UK, but also in Minnesota. As part of our permit with the state, we agreed to a number of practices, frankly, that were demanded of us indirectly by proper management of litter for the poultry industry, but we also absorb a number of measures to ensure that the poultry industry, the local community, is comfortable with our operation. So we operate fully tarped, rigid tarped trucks. We'll work with the trucking company to ensure that they properly manage the loading at the site. We, while not the trucking company, will generally contract it. We have a lot of control over their operations. We're going to be very demanding on the routes they want. We're going to be very demanding on the types of equipment they use, because that equipment is not only important to how we transfer, but how it's managed within our own facilities. So we'll demand tightly parked trucks. Those trucks will follow paths that we'll come to an agreement with area growers, with the local municipality. We'll do in such a way to try to minimize the impact of truck transfer. And quite frankly, in a community, it's often not the facility that's viewed as much as the truck transfer. So we'll do it in such a way to minimize its impact in the area. Once it arrives at our facility, and this is where the grower will see a lot of value, is we bring the truck in, we'll weigh it, we'll identify where it came from. We end up being, to that grower, part of his manure management plan. We'll be able to demonstrate that this is what he generated and this is where it went. But also importantly, as part of this weighing in and weighing out, is the grower is going to receive whatever is arranged in the form of revenue is going to be done on actual weight, not estimated weight. We'll have a payload in, a empty truck out, and from that we'll credit the grower for the actual amount of litter that's generated. That's something that's often not understood out in the industry as a whole, because there hasn't been a lot of emphasis on properly identifying the actual quantity of litter that's generated. So in many cases, they get substantial amount more money than they would have expected because we're actually weighing the price. Important to the community is, in after it goes through the scale house, if during that time it's going to have a covered tarp the whole way, it will eventually be directed into one of the reception bays in Minnesota. That's six particular reception bays. Everything that happens with poultry litter, from the transfer from the truck to the transfer to us, is done inside the building. As they came in the scale house, they'll be tracked from that point to the building, delivery of the litter, and ultimately on the back end, they'll go through a truck wash. Each step along the way, they have to go through step A, B, C, and D to move through the process and ultimately out the plant. What that does is allows us to demonstrate and show that they're following all the steps that we require as part of litter management on our site. The trucks come in, before they're allowed to do anything, the doors will go down. Why do those doors go down? Well, the best thing to do to ensure that the poultry smell, the odor, is not a burden in the area is make sure that it's kept in the building. We'll do that through what's called negative pressure. So really what we're doing is drawing air from our fuel hall from the storage area. In drawing the air for our combustion process, we're constantly pulling air into the building. By pulling air into the building, if you were to stand in front of these truck bays, if you were to stand in front of any of the personal access doors, you'll feel the actual movement of air in the building. To demonstrate that, and something that we certainly would always encourage the board to consider, is an actual tour of the facility where multiple, where you have the opportunity not only to see the operation, but also talk to the local community. Once the trucks come into the plant, the doors will go down, the light will go on, they'll be released to go roll down the tarp. In most cases, we'll do a sample, because we're treating that litter as a fuel, and we'll have a contractual arrangement with the grower that's going to be based on its fuel value. So we'll test, establish its moisture content, potentially establish its ash content, and from that's how we'll ultimately work our revenue with the growers based on the fuel quality it sends to us. After we take the sample, if it's acceptable, and when I say acceptable, it's not too high in moisture, what we'll do is allow them to tip it into the fuel storage area. If you were to go to, and I'll have diagrams that might help a little bit with this. If you were to go to the facility, from the outside, you would see the doors, the trucks go in. There's a barrier between the truck area and our fuel hall, so we create another barrier to ensure that whatever odor is in the littering will be there. It is retained in the building by always keeping multiple barriers and airflow into the facility. In general, we design our facility with multiple days of supply. We found that that's actually an important criteria for the quality of our fuel. In Minnesota, that can represent anywhere from 3 to 5 days supply. That might be up in the neighborhood of 10,000 tons of poultry litter, pretty substantial amount that we manage on site at any one time. To kind of pick up again on the truck side of things, once the trucks have gone in, as you can see with this picture, there'll be a platform up top where samples can be taken. They'll be directed into particular locations. We'll try to, where we can, know enough about the grower that we can anticipate field quality. We can direct them to the proper base. So in the end, we can try to minimize the challenges we have by creating a more consistent fuel by how we manage the litter. Important to the community, important to us, and important to the poultry industry that every litter truck that comes in, goes in and releases, tips its fuel. On its way out, it has to go through a step using cards that directs it through the truck wash. As the trucks go through there, it's not a detergent wash, it's a high pressure water wash in conjunction with a biocide that will basically disinfect it, so once it goes back on the road, it's going to meet the needs of the poultry industry, and it's also going to be a benefit in the fact that it's not tracking materials from the facility into the nearby community. As we said, so what is poultry litter? Well, it's what the birds eat. What do the birds eat? Generally corn and soybean. There will be other nutrients that are added to that because of the bird feed requirements. It's supplied on the grower schedule. When I say that, in other words, we have a relationship with the grower, we're going to require a certain amount of that litter to be supplied to us, but we're also going to create a lot of latitude on how they deliver it. Because we recognize that they don't have total control over the schedule. In general, it's the processing plant that will control when the birds come out. So we have to design a facility that's going to manage that day-to-day fluctuation. What we do is manage excess litter. What do I mean by that? In general, we do not develop a plant with the idea of taking all the litter. In most cases, we'll design it for need, as demonstrated by the growers. But what we use as a benchmark is about 50% of the litter that's generated in an area. I think I've noticed in some of the questions is where is that litter coming from? Is it just coming from Page County? We recognize that the entire poultry industry will value a service like this. So wherever the plant is located, you can anticipate that it's going to get litter from other counties in the general region. Not only does that allow us to build a plant that's large enough to meet the needs of the poultry industry, but it also will meet the needs of the utility that will have to sell the electricity to. As I said, we also utilize other materials. What are those materials in Minnesota and in most other plants would probably be woody biomass. So it'll be wood shavings, can be sawdust. In most cases, because of the design of our plant, we can handle very wet material, we can handle high ash material, so we're able to utilize wood that other biomass facilities wouldn't find value in. So what we often will do is have arrangements with timbering or lumber companies to manage their biomass, the lop and pop, the tops of the trees and the branches, and other forest residue that right now may not have a market. So we provide them an opportunity for an additional revenue stream. We also do use other materials, but always biomass materials. And the reason why we're going to be very restrictive and very careful on what we use is not only are we producing electricity, but we're also producing a nutrient material in the back end. We'll be very careful on the types of material we receive, because we know to market that we're going to have to meet very tight fertilizer requirements for the contents of that material. As I mentioned, secondary biomass is a key constraint. In typical fashion, probably about 80 to 85% is our target design for poultry litter. The rest will be secondary biomass. On some days, it may be 60% secondary biomass. In most cases, we're not going to go above 85 by too much, because poultry litter is a challenge. We actually like having the secondary biomass in there. It allows us to meet the fluctuation, but it also allows us to get it from storage into the boiler. It helps us mitigate some of the high moisture content. But really, it's probably most important, allows us to store a lot of litter, large piles, and then still be able to reclaim them. So how does the plant work? What is the basic process? Not really rocket science. This is technology that has been around and continues to be used for most biomass. We utilize a standard combustion to steam process. From the steam, we make electricity and turbines. In each of our plants, we try different technologies. A parent company of ours have tried other forms like gasification and other materials. The realistic thing is we have to meet the needs of poultry industry and growers. What we found in the four previous plants is a standard design that is very typical for a woody biomass plant, a spreader stoker boiler, and on the back end, we adapt very extensive emission control equipment to recognize the unique aspects of poultry litter. When the fuel comes in, it will be tracked. It'll be stored and, in a sense, followed from the point of arrival to the point it goes to our boiler. In the fuel hall, it'll be conditioned. One of the important points is we draw our air for our combustion process from the fuel hall, but we also have equipment available to recognize that that boiler will not be up and operating at all times. During those periods of time, we want to continue to maintain that same negative pressure that will be bringing air into it. So what we will have is a backup ventilation system. In that ventilation system, it'll continue to draw air in. It'll be available when the boiler's down. That material will be filtered. The odors that are in it will be neutralized and then released from a stack as well. In most cases, our plants are up and operating in the neighborhood of 85 to 90% of the time. So by and large, that negative pressure is going to be maintained by the operation use of that air in the combustion process. We take the litter. While I don't have a picture of it, we found the most appropriate means to deal with material that stinks is once it's discharged into the fuel hall, we'll move it to one end, typically by cranes. So there'll be overhead cranes that will move it from the reception pit into the fuel storage area, and it'll progressively move and blend it until on the back end it'll go through a filter process where we would remove sticks, rocks, things that will not go into the combustor because of size. Our typical fuel, if you were to look at it, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1-inch particle size and less. So it's a pretty fine material that goes into the combustion process. Once the material goes in and it's basically sprayed across the grate, if you think of a fireplace, what you're putting logs on, the grate is what the unburned fuel goes on. Up in the furnace, it goes through primary air, secondary air, and tertiary air to ensure that we have complete combustion. It isn't entirely complete because every combustion process you will have some leftover material. But by and large, we want to extract the energy from it. So it's a very effective, very efficient combustion process. It'll go from the heat from the furnace will come in contact with boiler tubes. From that, steam will be generated. Steam will go through a steam turbine, and from there, electricity will be generated and sent out to the transmission grid. If you've seen most power plants, not all, but many power plants, you'll notice that they'll have large cooling towers with billowing steam coming from the cooling towers. We recognize in most cases that the communities we go to value the water supply, certainly in the southeast of the United States, that's the case. So rather than utilizing a wet cooling tower, which you normally would see at a power plant, we use what's called an air-cooled condenser. Basically, it's a gigantic radiator. The air-cooled condenser will take the steam, recondense it, which in other words is bring it back down to water, and recirculate that water through the globe. To do this over and over again, you will have some loss of steam, some loss of the water. So we do have a water requirement that's not associated with the cooling. It's really only associated with producing boiler quality water. So when we first evaluated up in Minnesota, because of the very cold conditions up there, we were a little concerned about an air-cooled condenser. So we were originally contemplating a wet cooling tower. At that facility, it would have utilized about 1,000 gallons per minute if you were using a wet cooling tower. By using an air-cooled condenser, we were able to reduce the water usage to about 10% of what that would have required. It's very appropriately acknowledging the value that the community places on water, and it also indirectly reduces the impact of the steam plume associated with the cooling tower. Once the boiler water goes through, as I said, through the condenser, it'll go back and be recycled many times. We do produce a water effluent. And when I say water effluent, really what it is we'll get the raw water, it's city water. In Minnesota, it's well water. That well water is very hard. To make water boiler quality, you have to remove things like hardness. So the effluent we have at our facility up in Minnesota, and when I say effluent, I'll explain a little further, it's not really an effluent. It really is raw water that's higher in the hardness, higher in the mineral content that was in the raw water to start out with. In Minnesota, and as we'll do here and other projects, is we have a companion ash byproduct fertilizer process that will ultimately have a substantial water need. What we try to do is design our project in such a way that the water that we use for the boiler and the leftover material from water treatment to get the boiler ready water will be utilized in the ash fertilizer process. They do require water to make the type of fertilizer product that they use in the marketplace. So we try to stress, while we will have a water requirement, we try to design it in such a way that we will not have a water discharge from the plant. So when questions are asked is where will your water go, our expectation, and as I'll explain, we're early in this process, I can't say for certain what our water balance is, we don't know water quality where we're going here in Virginia. But certainly the design is to minimize our water use and reuse what we can so that we do not have discharge. We will recover ash from the process. It'll be recovered from the bottom of our furnace as well as from up in the heat transfer area, basically where the heat comes in contact with the tubes, and on the back end of the process. In our Minnesota project, as we would expect here, we've been able to reuse and ultimately manufacture through a third party all of that fertilizer product into a licensed fertilizer in Minnesota. So again, it's not just the electricity and energy we're producing, but it's also a recycling of the nutrients. This may be hard to kind of understand, but I'll try to go in a very general way of what happens in the process, what it looks like. This is a cutaway diagram of our Minnesota project, the fiber manufacturing. On the bottom left corner, as I said, we'll scale all the trucks in and out. Once the truck will arrive, it'll be told where to go in the truck staging area, which is in the bottom right corner. From there, it'll have a panel that will say which bay for it to go into. Again, we're trying to manage the litter in a way to increase the fuel. It will back up inside, doors will go down, the material will be released, there's a partition between those trucks and our fuel storage area. As you can kind of see, though I know it's a little difficult, the material will be moved by cranes. On the back end, it'll go through screening. As I said, we'll have a few other materials in it, like rocks and the like. We'll take that out. In most cases, we're able to recycle that material, but if we have any type of waste associated with the process, that's the one place where we might generate some residual waste. From the fuel haul, it'll go up a conveyor, and if you can kind of detect the fuel conveyor, it's covered, fully covered fuel conveyor. The air that's in that will be drawn into the boiler, as well as the air under another duct that's pulling from the fuel haul itself. On the outside of that building, that's where we would have our backup ventilation for backup emergency control of odors. So in all of our operations for fuel, we try to maintain and segregate a particular area to properly control odor. The boiler itself, you'll see in the back left-hand corner. In Minnesota, we don't have it designed yet in Virginia. The boiler house is about 150 feet tall. Generally, that's pretty typical for the size of a boiler. So it is, in scale, reasonably big. Within the boiler house, the litter fuel, which will be in combination with secondary biomass, will be stored in hoppers, injected into the furnace, the heat will be generated. Ash will come from the bottom of it, and while not depicted in here, go off to the third-party nutrient company. To develop a project like this, and I'll try to touch on it a little at the tail end, is we have to go through an extremely involved permitting process. To do a plant like this in this day and age, you have to incorporate very efficient, very proactive emission control system. In Minnesota, we use what's called selective non-catalytic reduction. And I know Greg is looking at me saying you're being an engineer again. Basically, what we are trying to control is the trace emissions that come from it. A SNCR, or selective non-catalytic reduction, is really what it is injecting a source of nitrogen into the furnace. So what nitrogen oxides are generated can be reduced. In most cases, you can control nitrogen oxide emissions by good combustion, but generally heat will create some nitrogen oxides. What we will do is try to reduce them generally in the 50 to 60% range. From the back end of the furnace, it'll go, in this case, in Minnesota. And I can't say for certain what our approach will be in Virginia. It'll certainly be as effective and efficient as it is in Minnesota, but I think it's been almost 10 years since we permitted. It would be very likely that we'll be going through a much more strict and comprehensive emission control requirement here in the state. It'll go through a spray dryer absorber that is basically, and if you can see it, though it's hard to depict, it's with a tube going into it on the left-hand side. Let's see if I can. In this area, that's a spray dryer absorber. In that area, what we'll do is blow in a very a concentrated lime slurry material that will capture sulfur content in it, capture chlorine content in it. It's associated with the sulfur that's in corn and soybeans, the chlorine that may be in salt or the drinking system. What we do is design a system basically that's going to be protective and represent best available control technology, which I'll talk about. Beyond that, it goes through a fabric filter bag house. In each case with the emissions, we are monitored on a continuous basis, taking individual emission readings, say every 10 seconds. As part of that, we're required to send that to the both the U.S. EPA and the state government. So we're very closely monitored for our moment-to-moment operation. In some cases, there are not monitors that can look at each and every aspect of the process. So what we'll do to supplement those emission monitors, we'll also do periodic stack tests. I noticed that there are a number of questions in Minnesota case. We designed that process with a 300-foot stack. It isn't necessarily the stack height that we would go with here in Virginia. In many cases, the stack height is doing much like what your fireplace does. It's diluting the small amount of emissions that are in there, so by the time they come down to ground level, they'll be at levels that have been demonstrated now for 40 years to be at levels considered safe to even the most vulnerable, such as kids and elderly people. What we'll have to do is go through a multiple amount of steps to demonstrate that the emissions that we have, which will be there but in small quantity, will be protective of not only public health, but the environment. And in this case, since we're in the proximity to a lot to National Park, we'll also have to demonstrate that we'll be very protective of visibility in the area. If you look at this, this is the air cooled condenser. It is very predominant. It's a very large piece of equipment. What it is fans underneath, the steam tubes going back and forth, and indirectly basically taking that high pressure steam and bringing it back down to water, so it's going to be eventually pumped in and recreate steam for recovery. We do have a water requirement. We'll have an on-site water treatment area that's taking the raw water and making it into boiler quality water. As I indicated, we also will produce on the back end a very valuable nutrient material. Now, that nutrient material isn't the same as litter because it's not containing nitrogen. And I know in most cases people would ask, well, how can you use it as a source of nutrients if it doesn't contain nitrogen? One of the issues with litter is it is a good fertilizer, even though it's a very dilute fertilizer. But the problem is the birds don't generate the nutrients in balance with what crops need. So in some case, you're going to have a nutrient somewhere that's out of balance. In most cases, in most row crops, they'll require a much higher quantity of nitrogen than phosphorus. So what we're able to do in this process is take that excess litter, indirectly extract the nitrogen out and provide a remaining nutrient thing that's high in phosphorus, that's high in potassium, but will in a sense allow for a better balance of nitrogen application in litter and phosphorus application either in litter or through this form of fertilizer, so that when a farmer is using it, they're using it at agronomic rates, which basically means a sustainable rate of nutrient application according to the plant needs. Not according to the one nutrient that's in highest demand, nitrogen, but according to what the crops actually need. In most cases, where we found in Minnesota, it's not only valued for the P and K content, but unlike commercial fertilizer, it has micronutrients. The poultry litter that's used will contain trace materials like sulfur. It will also include trace minerals and metals that are needed for the plant's health. So it'll have zinc, iron, a number of micronutrients that may not be available from a commercial fertilizer, but would be from a very dry fertilizer that we produce. One of the values of our ash material is, unlike litter, which is often applied in tons per acre, we're applying it in hundreds of pounds per acre, and typically doing it on a yearly or more likely biannual basis, every 2 years. And what does that mean? Well, it is concentrated, and most importantly, if not required or not used in the area, because it's concentrated, we can move it out of the area. Why is that important? As I indicated before, this area continues to be a sink for nutrients as long as crops are coming in and nutrients aren't going out. Either it's on the ground and used by the crop, or excess may be, you know, in excess in the soil, or if not managed, you know, in the proper way, can become a burden to local waterways. And we found one of the big attractions in a number of areas where we've been introduced to lately is the ability to assist the state in their adherence to, you know, managing some of the challenges they have in the Chesapeake Bay. Just to give you kind of an overview of what is in the act, fertilizer. In many cases, we're finding with the third-party company up in Minnesota is they are taking this material and looking for natural forms of nitrogen to augment it where needed. In most cases in Minnesota, because this is high in P and K, it's going to crops that don't have a nitrogen requirement. So in Minnesota, a lot of this material actually is going to sugar beets that don't have a high nitrogen requirement. In general, it's calcium, which offers calcium is lined. It offers advantages for lining capacity. 16.5% phosphorus, and this will vary. It'll vary on our blend of biomass to litter, but this gives you kind of a level of the concentration of phosphorus and potassium. Depending on whether it's chicken, broilers, or turkey, in general, chickens will have a much more balanced amount of phosphorus and potassium. In addition to that, it'll have other materials like silica, magnesium, sodium, sulfur, a little bit of chlorine. What it has, as I indicated, is trace micronutrients. And those are some of the values that farmers in Minnesota and elsewhere see in this material. So I guess as was, you know, indicated at the very beginning of the presentation, where will this plant be cited? Where are we in the process right now? Well, we have a lot of work to do and a lot of evaluation, because to build a plant like this, there's a lot of factors that are going to go into its location, size, and its ability to work in conjunction with the other utilities. We require adequate site acreage. In Minnesota, we're on a 77-acre site. On that site, we probably are actually utilizing about 25 acres of it. It sits on a wetland area. As a result, those wetlands will be retained and valued by the local community. At its very heart, the physical capital of the building are probably in the neighborhood of 7 to 10 acres in size. We like to build it in a location where we have adequate buffer around it. So typically we'll look for a site, if we need 24, maybe in the neighborhood of 3 times that in acreage. 75 acres, 100 acres, that's probably a good size for a project like this. We need to have access to transmission lines. We're not selling the electricity to the residents. We can't. We're not a regulated utility. So we need to have access to a transmission line. To get access to a transmission line, we generally have to go through a very extensive study with utilities. In general, we're putting the electricity onto the grid, onto the transmission grid, not the distribution grid that will come to individual houses, to the transmission grid. And depending on the size, it's typically in the neighborhood of about 115 kilovolt line. So in most cases, that's on a modest transmission line. In Minnesota, our 115 kV line is probably 40 feet up in the air. It's taller than your normal distribution line, but not like the high voltage lines that you might see going through corridors. In our plant, it sits on roughly a 50-foot easement. So again, not a large area that's associated with that transmission line. Other key components that can't be ignored is we're not going to be able to do a project until we know we have a customer of ours. which is the cultural, or is the public utilities. We've had initial contact with a number of utilities. Virginia has a renewable energy voluntary requirement, and there are utilities that see the value of a plant like this as potentially meeting their requirements. But for us to move forward, we have to understand and be very comfortable that we're going to be able to get a power purchase agreement with the utility. We also will have to go through a rather extensive process that Eric Jenkins will be responsible for, of working with the individual grower. Our relationship is with the family farm, the individual poultry grower, because they are the ones that will have the long-term relationship, the contract with. In Minnesota, what we've done is we have 10-year supply contracts. What that means is we can be assured that for 10 years, as they generate litter, and as they have that litter available, they'll supply it to us according to the agreed to requirements. In some cases, it can be a lot of a particular farm's litter. In some cases, just a small amount. It's up to the grower on how much they would send to a project like that. Each of those growers is going to value this service in a different way. Most of them, in many areas, we're going to continue to rely on land application of poultry litter. What we'll do is take what they would consider their excess litter, either because they don't have a home for it, or the area can't withstand the amount of nutrients. We'll also require adequate utilities. As I said, we do have a water requirement. It's for an industrial facility, pretty modest. I think in Minnesota, that which is a plant that's 55 megawatts, and it is utilizing rather hard water, we utilize about 130 gallons per minute. As I had indicated, we were looking originally at a potential requirement of about 1,000 gallons per minute using a wet cooling tower. So its water requirements are rather modest for an industrial facility. We'll also obviously have to go through a very extensive permitting process. That permitting process will have to be anticipated even before we site a project. We'll have to know that that permit can be granted in that area. We have a good idea of what emission control will be required, but we'll have to do a lot more studying to ensure that that emission control, in conjunction with our plan and a particular area, is permittable. And then more than anything, our real, the crux of a project being successful is the ability to put all those in place and be able to demonstrate in a way that we can finance the project. The development process we go through is, and I'll kind of point out where I think we are here in Virginia, is we'll get that initial state, that initial local interest in having a solution. A community, a county that recognizes the poultry industry is important to the county, recognizes that they have waterways that they would like to see protected, and recognizes that they have certain needs from the perspective of tax revenue, job retention, job creation, and basically a demonstrated ability to recognize the benefit that this can offer a community in a sustainable community. We'll do outreach with the poultry industry. Obviously, there are two parts of the poultry industry. There's the individual grower, and there is the company that does ultimately the processing of the birds. We need to understand the value and needs of that entire industry. But by and large, we'll reach out and make contact with the growers, and they'll be the ones that we'll have a contract with. That contract will be, as I said, 10 years. It'll indicate how much litter they're committing to. It'll acknowledge the fact that if they are not raising birds, they obviously can't produce litter. It will talk about how that relationship will exist in the way of their revenue, the invoicing, their perceived need. They choose how much they want to sell to the facility. But we'll have to have a good understanding of that outreach to move on to the next part, of that interest to move on to the next part of this. We've begun some initial discussions on power purchase agreements, what we need to do, and in many respects, we have multiple masters that we have to meet. We have to be able to, as a utility, demonstrate a very cost-effective, viable project that has a low generating cost, one that is acceptable to the ratepayers. We also have to have a power purchase agreement that they need in a particular area. It ends up being really the anchor of our entire process. In Minnesota, as we expect everywhere, these are long-term power purchase agreements. With the utility up in Minnesota, that is a 21-year agreement. We would expect to have similar arrangement here in the state. To produce 40 megawatts over 21 years is a lot of revenue flowing in one direction to us. It'll take a lot of due diligence on the part of the public utility to make a commitment like that. But we'll have to be very comfortable and confident that we'll have that before we would move on to the next stage, typically. During that same time, we'll go through site evaluation. As I said, what are some of the key criteria? The size, the utility, the access to it, truck access to it, where the supply is, where the transmission lines are located. We'll do a lot of site evaluation. In most cases, those are sites, not that we've gone out and looked for, but that have been brought to us. Well, then, once we're comfortable with the position on the power purchase agreement, we'll then enter into the permitting process. It's costly, extensive. It's very visible. It's open to a lot of public comments. It's meeting rules and regulations that have been developed starting in 1970 that recognize all the different aspects of what a plant like this needs to be evaluated for. We'll go through our design work. Some of it will be required up front to be able to permit, to be able to meet the requirements of the EPA, the agreement with utility. We'll then go through financing, construction, and ultimately operation. I think the natural question is, well, how much time does that involve? In general, it's hard to pinpoint the site evaluation, because basically that's reflective of the type of support we have, why in a particular host community. In many cases, negotiations with power companies can take months. To in Minnesota or in North Carolina, where we're currently developing three projects, it's taken years. We think right now in the marketplace and the attraction of renewable energy that we can do this in a very reasonable amount of time. While we're going through that negotiation, we will do permitting, we'll do the permit preparation work. Typically, you could say permitting could take 6 months, but in most cases, it's an involved process with public hearings, public comments, back and forth discussions that one can anticipate is usually at a minimum of about a year. Once we have the permits in hand, all during that time, we would be lining up the financing for a project like this. What we do when we finance a project like this is finance it as a project. We're not a public utility. We don't have the equity available like a utility would have because they have a lot of ratepayers. So we'll go through what's called project finance, where the performance of the plant itself, therefore the requirement of the power purchase agreement, is how the entire project is evaluated, the revenue streams that go with that. In general, financing can happen pretty quickly after you have a PPA and a permit, because they know those are usually the two biggest steps. Our construction period here in the state of Virginia, as we found in many parts around the southern part of the country, it's probably about a 24-month time period. So what are the benefits? Why do I feel the commissioners and county here and other counties around the country looked at a fiberglass solution and some of the reasons why they see value in having this kind of development in their county. As I mentioned, it helps sustain the poultry industry. In this area, you know, I know there are a multitude of employers, but certainly the poultry industry is a dominant anchor employer here in the area. It provides sustainability. You want this industry to have options, have opportunities to remain successful in the area. In most cases, we deal with the individual farmer who's under a lot of burden from regulatory constraints on how he manages his litter, how he manages his nutrients, paperwork. This does a lot to alleviate the burden for an individual poultry farmer. It also strengthens the local poultry industry. One of the biggest challenges for the poultry industry is how do you grow? The only way you generally grow is having an opportunity to find alternatives for litter. It also provides something they can do year-round. We're open 12 months of the year, so they can build their schedule around their own needs rather than the needs of the farmer's crop planting and harvesting cycle. It also provides, in many cases, an opportunity for a grower to purchase bedding material, which we may very well supply. Again, as I said, we're trying to meet the needs of the poultry industry where we can. But it allows them to purchase or utilize bedding in a more opportune, more economically beneficial time. And it enhances biosecurity for the poultry industry. Some of the other reasons that this is a benefit is certainly construction jobs. In Minnesota, there were periods of time where we had as many as 300 to 400 employees, construction employees on site. Now, I noticed in one of the questions, it was raised, will these be construction jobs coming only from the community or from this area? Typically, we operate in a way that we'll have a general contractor, what we call an EPC contractor, engineering, procurement, and construction contractor, that will be responsible for the design and ultimately the construction labor. They typically want to reach out to the local community to try to utilize construction labor as close to the point of building the plant as possible. So there'll be a lot of opportunities for construction jobs in this area. They're very high-paying construction jobs. They're electricians, plumbers, instrument techs, pipe fitters. There are a number of different opportunities for employment in a project like this. Will also result in anywhere from 90 to 100 permanent jobs. Those are broken down within the neighborhood of 30 to 35 at our site. While we haven't put all the details together to a project in Virginia, in our typical wage scale, using Minnesota's example, is we have the average wage for the entire workforce is in the neighborhood of $35,000 to $40,000 a year. So they're pretty good paying jobs. We also will work with the transportation companies. In most cases, yes, these are truckers that may be out there right now, but this is transportation that's not being done out there right now. So this ends up being additional trucking opportunities. Litter right now is generally moved by the local grower or the farmer. In this case, these will be new jobs. And to use kind of an example in Minnesota, because of the number of transportation jobs in Benson, Minnesota, one of the contractors that supply the transportation services actually moved their headquarters from downstate Minnesota to Benson. That indirectly brought support for the transportation they provide to the Fiberman project. But it also brought other jobs that never would have been anticipated associated with our plant and opportunities in that area. Importantly, this is a large capital investment. We require a lot of service jobs. There's been studies done on renewable energy projects like this. It's not unusual to expect at a minimum an additional 100 indirect jobs. So what do I mean by that? Either services to our plant, services that are needed by the employees of our plant, trucking companies and the like, or just the basic dollars that are going to flow into the community. We've seen some economic studies that say can be anywhere from 1 to 3 times. So if we were to be responsible for 100 jobs, it might be anticipated that additional other 100 jobs to 300 jobs might be supported by the addition of a plan like this. In general, we'll be purchasing our fuel supplies in addition to poultry litter and secondary biomass. We also will use a startup fuel in Minnesota, and in most cases, it probably won't be natural gas because natural gas, you have to buy capacity for supply, and we're only using a small amount of gas for startup of the plant. It'll usually be propane. That's the way we found it to be, even though propane is more expensive, building in the capacity for the plant may make natural gas more expensive to us. So we'll have propane sales. We'll have maintenance and service sales for the area. So there'll be a lot of spin-off employment associated with this. To use a, you know, I recognize that one of the important questions that are asked is, what does it mean to the community? What does the community get from it? And since we haven't gone through the full development process here, the only thing I can use is Minnesota as an example. Our project up in Minnesota has contributed in 2009, and will continue well into the project. We pay roughly $800,000 a year in taxes. We represent probably about 20 to 30% of the tax income of the city of Benson. In addition to that, we're getting an additional roughly $100,000 in taxes from the fertilizer plant and somewhat unexpected introduction of the trucking company to that area. So it is a very tangible, important ability to bring in tax revenue. In the case of Minnesota, we worked with the city of Benson for some of our infrastructure supply. They were able to work with the state and get some upgrades to the local roads. They were able to work with grant programs for the supply of, in that case, sewer service to their industrial park that did not have it. So it can be a lot of spin-off benefits that the city, the county can gain in addition to that. In getting that infrastructure out to our plant, in most cases, the original arrangement, say, for the sewer was that the city had to pay half and the state would pay half. Ultimately, the state paid half and we reimbursed the local community for that. We recognize that one of the advantages and benefits of us is providing a payback, an economic benefit, more than just employment, but also to help sustain the community through tax payments. As I said before, we produce direct jobs at the plant, indirect jobs through transportation, spin-off jobs associated with the support services that may not be directly related to the plant, but we also are a job protection for the poultry industry. If you know anything about raising poultry in this day and age, it's not done just in Virginia, it's done all around the country, and is under more and more pressure from other countries, where poultry is becoming very important to their economy. What this does is helps provide some flexibility for the poultry industry to better manage some of the challenges they have and make them sustainable in this area. We make sure that we're good neighbors. One of the obvious questions is, talk about odor. Now, obviously, there's a lot of litter. How can you demonstrate that odor won't be an issue? Well, we demonstrate it by having proper transport, tightly controlled trucks. We operate with the doors closed to ensure that what odor is there stays in the building. We operate with a backup odor control system, because odor is obviously one of the key issues that a community is concerned about before they would welcome a project like this. But just as important is, by absorbing some of this litter, we can cut down some of the odor impact that excess amount of litter can have on the local community. By managing in trucks, bringing it to our plant, we will indirectly, you know, benefit the overall odor burden that the general area might have to absorb. We designed our process to minimize noise issues. Indirectly, that's really as a result of the fact that we're dealing with a smelly material like the litter. All of our operations are done basically indoors. Our fuel is stored indoors. Our conveying is done in enclosed conveyors. Our boiler house is closed, and the emission control are all closed pieces of equipment. In addition to that, what we've done and would do here is demonstrate that we would have a very negligible impact from a noise perspective. We did initial noise surveys before the plant was built. We built into our specification pipe noise control. And then on the backside, we actually did a noise survey to demonstrate that we would have a very negligible impact in the area. We also work with the community to make sure that our trucks go the right routes, that people have an opportunity to comment on the way we manage trucks, how we run the trucks, where we run the trucks. In Minnesota, every one of our litter trucks has our name on it. It may not be our truck, but the truck will indicate that it's going to Fiberman. And therefore, if there were to be an issue with the way that its speed, whether odor is an issue, they have a place that they can go to. As part of our arrangement with the community, we'll have an ability to, if you have a complaint, complain about an issue. In Minnesota, we've been up and operating for 2.5 years. We have not had a formal odor complaint since we've been up and operating. And I think most importantly, go up and talk to the people that are up there and find out how successful we've been able to manage odor up in that area. We also try to design the plants in an architecturally appropriate way. In Minnesota, we actually worked with that citizens advisory panel to help work a bit on the layout so it was compatible with land uses in and around there. They helped with choosing the look of the buildings, the colors of the buildings. It is an industrial facility, but if you look at this facility, you'll notice, and I hope you picked up on it earlier, in that by and large, it's an enclosed facility that's designed in such a way that will minimize the impact of the facility itself visually. We also will work very closely in a partnership with the local government. When we began the after siting in Minnesota, we set up task groups with the local government. We set up the citizens advisory panel to make sure they had an opportunity to raise questions and get answers. And if you're interested in what's been talked about, go to the website. The minutes of the past meetings are on at www.fibermincap.org. So you can go and see some of the questions that I suspect a lot of people here in the building today are asking. Those are the same questions in many cases that were asked up in Minnesota, and likewise have been asked down in North Carolina. What are the benefits to the environment? There are benefits to the environment. Nutrient management, as I said, is an issue of high priority to the state of Virginia right now. They are under pretty strict obligations to minimize their impact to the Chesapeake Bay. They are obligated to show very tangible reductions, and we would expect that a plant like this would be able to demonstrate in a very tangible and appropriate way how important, how successful the state of Virginia has been in reducing nutrients, which end up being a very important aspect of Chesapeake Bay protection, how we can help with providing the right balance for nutrient management. It can avoid water impacts from litter. Litter, as I said, is not always the most easy material to use as a fuel. It's also not easy necessarily to use as a source of nutrients. It can be applied in multiple tons per acre. And by providing a route for this excess litter, it will ensure that the amount of litter used is done in an agronomic way, and therefore can help protect resources that I think that you value here, like the Shenandoah River. I mean, that is a very important resource that I suspect you very much want to protect. We also reduce greenhouse gas emissions. When I say reduce, we don't eliminate greenhouse gas emissions, but what we do is we displace fossil fuel fired power plants that do add greenhouse gases. The plant will generate, as part of our combustion process, carbon dioxide, which is typically identified as the issue with greenhouse gases. It's one of many. Another is methane, which also can be associated with poultry litter management and storage. While we produce CO2, that CO2 is produced and indirectly comes from a natural source, so we're viewed as what might be characterized as carbon neutral. Cycle of the carbon into the plant, into the trees, used for production of electricity. It does go up in the atmosphere, but it's in balance through the environment, unlike a fossil fuel-fired power plant, which is pulling carbon out of the ground and adding to the overall concentration. In addition to being carbon neutral from our combustion process, litter management can be a source of greenhouse gas emissions as well. So we can provide an added benefit of not only being carbon neutral, but actually reducing the greenhouse gases associated with litter management. Just to kind of put it in summary, what we're talking about when we talk about greenhouse gases is the carbon cycle. What we'll do is take the energy, I mean, really what we are is we're solar power. A different form of solar power, but the energy that comes from the sun is locked up in the plant, solar power, and what we're doing is making use of that stored solar power. Might sound a little absurd, and I'm not suggesting that we're solar power like a solar panel, but what we're doing is our real fuel source in the end are the plants that are fed by and large by the sun. It's a different form of solar power. The biomass that we use will be, as I said, often brought into the area. The carbon that's in there will be, through the combustion process, used, extracted. We'll gain heat from it. Carbon will go out as part of that carbon cycle and be reused by the plant, by the trees, by the lop and top biomass that we use as part of our other supply. And from that, we get electricity. As I said before, we produce ash and therefore recycle the nutrients. So what are the environmental considerations? I could spend a lot of time, and I know there are a lot of questions, but I'll try to highlight it because I know it's gone on for a while. We've been in operation and have a 17-year track record. That's 17 years of emission data that was used to support the development of the projects in the UK, and development of the project in Minnesota, and now will be used to demonstrate our ability to operate in the state of Virginia as well as North Carolina. That record shows a continual reduction of the emissions from these plants. As I said, there was a lot of work that had to be done on those first plants in the UK to progressively make them lower emitters. When I say lower emitters, we emit the air emissions that come. And in doing that, we've been able to significantly cut the emissions associated with the plant. We understand the fuel, we know how to burn it. Knowing how to burn it will reduce the creation of air emissions. We also know how to permit the projects. We know what was the expectation of the regulatory community and how we can demonstrate that we meet all the strict criteria that the US EPA and the state environmental regulatory agency will require here in the state. As our base in Minnesota, I suspect it'll be a little bit more involved here in Virginia. We use good combustion practices, NOx control of sulfur and chlorine, and ultimately collection of the dust or particulate matter in a fabric filter baghouse. We also, as I said, offer a whole portfolio of benefits: waterway protection, greenhouse gas reduction in ammonia. One of the key criteria for poultry farms is ammonia monitoring, ammonia issues. We're able to demonstrate a very real and tangible reduction in ammonia impacts. And we're also obviously able to demonstrate through multiple years of operation low odor issues. To use as a starting point in Minnesota, and like I said, I suspect our emission limits, these are the limits in Minnesota. We have a total particulate requirement in Minnesota of 0.02 pounds per million BTU. Pounds per million BTU, you understand the pounds. Million BTU is a unit of heat. So you compare power plants one to the other based on the amount of heat that they produce. Particulate matter of 0.02 pounds per million BTU. Sulfur dioxide, which is one of the emissions that we control for, we have an emission limit of 0.07 pounds per million BTU, or an 80% reduction. We typically get 85 to 90% reduction, and right now we're operating typically at about 0.01 to 0.02 pounds per million BTU. Nitrogen oxides, our permit limit in Minnesota is 0.16 pounds per million BTU. Right now we're operating at about 0.12 to 0.13, so it's well below that emission limit. Carbon monoxide, our emission limit is 0.24. Our typical emissions are in the neighborhood of about 0.15 to 0.16. So while we have the restrict permit limits, we actually, as much as anything, for better recovery of the heat, we operate at levels much below that. We also have to control HCL emissions. Chlorine can create HCL in the combustion process. Our actual emissions are in the neighborhood of about 0.003. So in each case, we're able to demonstrate emission limits that in Minnesota are probably not as strict as they will be here in Virginia, at levels well below even what we were permitted at. To get that permit, we had to demonstrate our operation going into the entire process in a multitude of worst case conditions. So we had to take the worst fuel we could use, and that usually means a very moist fuel. We had to take the worst meteorological conditions, worst weather, where what emissions come from the stack don't have an opportunity to dilute as much. So typically they'll fall quicker to the ground. We had to analyze the worst content of things like sulfur and chlorine. We had to evaluate as if we're operating at our maximum production all the time. So in each case, they look at a worst-case condition, and in doing that, run it through the permit process, the air dispersion modeling, and then compare it to health risk values, and demonstrate that the level that we would have emissions at are protective and well below what are considered to be safe limits. I doubt that I covered every one of the questions, but if you'd like, should I go ahead and pick up the questions that came, or would you like to bounce them off at me? I hope to have covered a lot of them.
Let the board ask you a few questions.
Sure.
All right.
Let me be very candid. This should not be the one and only opportunity for people to ask questions.
Correct.
I mean, what we did in Minnesota and we'll do here is before we chose a site in Minnesota, before we chose sites in North Carolina, we held open house meetings where the general public had an opportunity to come. Importantly, speak with people that had either grown up near an existing plant or preferably community leaders that have actually gone up, represented their community, and toured our facility, either in Minnesota or before we built Minnesota, they went up to the UK. So there are going to be multiple opportunities for us to be out and answer questions. Likewise, we'll try to answer questions either here or in some forum. We do have a new blog site called The Straight Poop, which basically was set up as a way to try to answer the questions that logically are going to come from any community that's considering this as you know a new addition to their local economy.
Okay. All right. At this point, our supervisor, if you've got a question you'd like to ask, we'll go to that for this. Who would like to speak up first? If you'd like to ask a question that's on the list, you can, or if there's a question that you have that's not on the list, then yes, you can ask that question too. Very good.
All right. I'll start.
Sir?
I'm sure we all do. First of all, I'm going to give you a chance to bring up the slides with the biomass power plant.
Which one is
the federal diagram? It's four of them. Just go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay.
Give me a second. The main, we're talking about levels. That's the last thing we talked about. What's really concerning people is the arsenic and dioxin. Okay, those weren't mentioned. Just take your Minnesota plant. If you know the levels of what comes out of that
smoke stack? Well, in general, any combustion product, any combustion source will have levels of emissions that will be represented with what was in the fuel and not collected in the emission control system. What we had to do as part of our process in Minnesota, and we'll be done here, is demonstrate the levels that we have operated at, utilize those levels to demonstrate we would be protected of public health by doing health risk assessments. We did testing in Minnesota for our metals. We did testing to look at issues like mercury. We have testing and indirectly ash composition to look at with regard to metals like arsenic. So we do have a very extensive record of results to show the emissions we have coming from the plant. Can I cite them offhand? No. I say this, in great caution because I know it will likely in the public create a little stir. I can't say for certain there won't be issues like dioxin. In the same way someone that's burning a candle or a fireplace or burning garbage in a burn barrel likewise can't say that. The important point is not whether it's there, it's how well all of these are controlled. Before we can build a plant like this, we're going to have to demonstrate that is done at a level that is extremely protective of public health.
But we will be able to see EPA studies on the amount that comes out
sure.
of certain smoke stack.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question when we were explaining this, okay, you've got six doors, you can get six tractor trailers at one time. But six tractor trailers back up to the conveyor belt.
They back up into the where it's tipped into
a
fuel bed, right?
Okay. The doors are put down, it's going to be oxygen. Neutral, where there's
flowing.
And there's flowing. It's coming from outside, and nothing's going back out. Okay. The smell, whatever, from that process is being burnt in the incinerator. That's where you're getting it out.
In the power plant, yeah. Okay. In the power plant.
In the back of the plant, in the back of the storage area there, what's the amount of waste, fuel, as you call it, that's being stored?
It'll vary because, and I remember now that there was a question on it. We basically only take our poultry litter during weekdays. In general, we try to meet the schedule of the ag community, so it's often 6 to 6. On occasion, we'll bring it in because a grower will have a need on the weekend. But because of it, you'll have kind of an ebb and flow. So on Friday, we'll have a lot of litter in there that will be used up over the weekend because we're not receiving it. On Monday morning, a lot of times it'll be very low at that point. it's typical that you have somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 to 10,000 tons of litter in storage at any time.
So we're going to say that probably about 3 days.
3 to 5, depending on pool quality, yeah.
Okay. So we're not hauling on the weekends. We're burning that. The workers, say, are in that environment. The door's shut. Certainly they're in on oxygen the whole time.
Not within the fuel reception area because of the flow of oxygen from, in addition to the doors, you'll also have the louvers to make sure that adequate air is coming in, even if all the doors are closed.
Okay.
Generally, we create another barrier between the fuel reception area where the trucks are and where the employees are and the actual fuel storage area. That's why we move the material with cranes. Based on the fact of the smell, there will be ammonia content in there, so we want to isolate our employees from the actual storage of the litter.
The wood shavings and sawdust, which you refer also, now would that be stored outside?
It can be. In many cases, to get our good blended fuel, majority will come in the door with the filter there. But in Minnesota, and in most cases in other areas, you probably will have some biomass storage on site. I think kind of going toward maybe one of the areas you might have been thinking about is, if you're not receiving on Saturday and Sunday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, how are you managing that?
Right. And periods, I mean, we've got a rough winter in Virginia.
Sure.
So there's been periods, I'd say a week, and probably you could even have got trips to get out a lot of the week. But one more question, I'll let my colleagues, the amount of propane that you're going to fire with to get this stuff going. You said a small amount, but is that going to be delivered? Our local concerns going to be?
That's the typical way.
Okay, I'll say railroad or
we want to use as little as possible. In most cases, we're obligated under our permit to start up our process on propane because they want it started up and the combustion temperature in the furnace to be high enough before we would put both in there or other biomass. But it's expensive, so we don't like to use it.
There's plenty of others I'm not sure.
How many trucks do you expect in a week?
I don't know in a week, and it'll vary depending on the actual size. I think you can expect that on a typical day it'll be over 100 trucks. In many cases, we would be sourcing, as I said, from multiple counties. A lot of it's going to depend on the overall interest that the power of the utility has, indirectly on how big the plant will be. The only way to feasibly move from these spread out farms is by truck transport. We've looked at models which might consider train, but what you're doing is you're doing multiple handlings. You're taking it from the farm, putting it in a truck, unloading it into the train. You may or may not have access for the train at a particular site. So we are very dependent on truck transport.
Another question I had was often are you in violation of the permit?
I'm glad you brought that up. Thanks. I overlooked that. I'm sure. We, with our plant up in Minnesota, we started up in May of 07. One of the issues we had to deal with is we were behind schedule. When I say we, actually the contractor was behind the schedule getting it up and operating. We had commitments that we had made to the poultry industry on utilizing their litter. We brought the plant up in conjunction with the contractor, frankly, very quickly. Normally, at a project like this, it would take about a half a year to go from initial startup, doing shakedown, setting up each of the systems, because each one of our emission control systems each aspect of it will have to be balanced with other funds. We would have, in a sense, reached that 180 days, done our testing, and from that point on, gone through the process with the continuous emission monitors. But because we came up with full production very quickly, our continuous emission monitors were on. We did have some non-compliance issues very early on. When this happened, at the very beginning of operation, we went and we spoke with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, explained our situation, what we were doing with the equipment, the corrections we were made. And as a result, as every regulatory agency will do, if you were to look at their compliance and enforcement thing, is they keep a very close watchful eye. I would have loved to be sitting here, or standing here, saying we had no issue up in Minnesota, but we did. We had some initial exceedances of the emissions at our permit, but we've now been operating for a year without any issues. This is part of the normal startup, shakedown, and optimization of the process. So yeah, you're right, we did.
Could you address a couple questions here? What, if your plan is in full operation and it's essentially located on approximately 75 acres of land, okay, or 75 to 100 acres, I think is approximately what you've stated. What kind of other businesses is located or factory that is very close to you in a to your plant in Minnesota or any other plant that's located close to you within a 2 acre spot?
Well, I'll start with the experience we have in the UK. Our projects were built in industrial parks. In some cases, they were built early on, in some cases, later in the build out of the industrial park. In facilities in the UK were located near food manufacturing plants, balloon manufacturing plants, feed mills for poultry production. So there's a diversity of use for the industrial park in the UK facilities. In Minnesota, our facility is built in, and again, we're relying on the local community to select the site that's appropriate. In Minnesota, we sit next to an ethanol plant. As I said, there is a fertilizer plant, the trucking company. Benson is a very isolated area. They worked very hard to find other development. There's nothing about a project like this that would preclude companion facilities because same criteria they would look at. In fact, they would probably value some of the attributes we bring to it because we will require the utilities that go with, you know, an industrial development. But there's nothing that would preclude any type of industry being located to us because we have to manage poultry there in a very protective way.
You know, you're also looking at approximately, get your calculations right, 300-foot stack.
Using Minnesota as the example, that's correct.
Right. 150-foot building.
Right.
You know, we have the Skyline Drive right here, and we have a lot of tourism that travels through. When you get on the drive and look out, and site is one of the prettiest things you can look at. Y'all done a study, maybe might be a better way to put it, of how that plant of that size and the trucking that you're talking about that can be carried through on the roads, how does that affect the tourism of that? I'd like to see a study of that.
You know, that's a hard thing to quantify. I think in any area, tourism is built on the natural resources that you have in the area. Here you have the caverns, you have Skyline Drive, you have the Shenandoah River. In developing our projects, we try to do it with the municipality to make it as unobtrusive as possible. Like I said, building it in such a way that the look of it is attractive to the area. What we would envision doing here is photo simulations before we would choose the site to kind of demonstrate what it would look like from various vantage points. Everyone kind of conceptually thinks that a project like that is going to be so visible. We would be surprised by tree buffers, setbacks, and issues like that, that it isn't as noticeable as you would expect.
I would ask everybody to please quiet down so we can hear the answers. And so you can hear them also, okay? So we hear questions and answers. I know everybody has statements, so please control that, all right? Thank you. I guess another one I have. You're saying it takes 2 years to complete construction. For 300 jobs. Construction jobs and possibly 9 to 100 inside plus structures. You look at that. If you get 100 trucks a day, that's probably actually more than that.
It will be on certain occasions, but that is for a 40 megawatt plant, that's probably the benchmark figure used.
Okay. How long will it take that plant to get full capacity for that many people to cover it? Immediately at 24 months?
No, from a construction perspective.
Yeah, you're saying the plan is done in 24 months. So let's say 24 months is up. Is it going to be a full operating capacity, or will it take from that point on another 2 or 3 years to get a full capacity? You're saving approximately $80,000 to $800,000 tax rate. Is that something that with the board to look forward to as it being in 24 months? Is that an actual figure, or is it something that's going to be prolonged to say, well, we got to get to this point before that actually occurs? What is the full capacity of that plant operating today?
In general, we would consider in that construction period the commissioning and initial startup.
Right.
So the 24 hours really covers the time from when the ground is broken from the plant to when it's at full operation. We typically have a startup that is in the neighborhood of six months, where we go from that first 3 months prior to what we call commercial operation. So we're up and operating before that, but where we're actually at commercial operating and slowly ramping up. Like I said, in Minnesota, we probably started it up and reached capacity too quickly, considering we were utilizing new technology. But once the contractor turns the plant over to us, it's at full capacity, because that's what they have to demonstrate to do that.
And you're saying the plant, when you're looking at 100 trucks a day, delivered from 6 to 6 Monday through Friday, but the plant actually operates 24 hours around the clock.
That's correct. All the employment at the site will be typically 3 or 4 shifts, so you always have people off. They'll operate, and I can't say exactly what is the most appropriate operating schedule for here, but during the daytime hours of say 8 till 5 is when your employment or your greatest number of employees will be on site. Just to kind of give you a feel for what are the different jobs occupied at the facility. We have the fuel reception people, so they basically are responsible for tracking the trucks that come in, making sure that they go through the proper movements, doing sample and testing. We'll typically have 2 or 3 possibly on each shift doing that exercise. In addition to that, we'll have boiler operators and control room operators. During the daytime hours, we'll have the greatest amount of our maintenance labor on site, so like the instrument techs, electricians doing that kind of maintenance. During the off hours, you may only have 6 people on site. You're not receiving litter in the front door. Really what you're doing is keeping the plant up and operating. So you employ 30 to 35 people, not all in one site at a time.
How many of those jobs would be people you would bring in from Minnesota or Carolina? How many? Would they be here just to train local people to run that plant?
Typically, I'm using an example. In Minnesota, because we did not have American experience with this particular plant, we went out into the labor force and brought people from other states to start up. At the time, we had hoped that they would stay on. In many cases, they did, because going to a rural area wasn't where they were from. In Minnesota, it's cold. That wasn't very attractive. We had a couple of employees that came from Florida and California. But what we also found is we had a labor force that was skilled, and most importantly, when we started to see people moving from initial jobs, I mean, we have one really good, or two really good examples. And if you're interested, I think we have some discussion of this on the Hyderwall website. One of our control room operators started actually as a security guard for the local contractor, started at an entry-level job in the fuel receiving area, has now moved up two or three different levels, and is now midway or to the upper echelon of the operating people. And she did that because we value people that are from the community, that they stay in the community. Our assistant plant manager, I forget his exact title, but that's the best way of portraying it, our operations manager, had worked in the armed forces, I think he was in the Navy, had a job in Iowa, but he was actually from not quite the Benton area, but within about 20 miles of the plant. When that plant opened, he was able to come back home, moved back onto his parents' farm. He brought his family and a number of brothers because he was from the community. We value the people from the community that have the skills. I mean, there's no guarantee that you have jobs. You have to have the skills to operate in that regime, but we value the people that come from the community. And since there's going to be adequate time from when a site's announced to when we'd be actually up and operating, there certainly are opportunities for gaining that skill set.
Another concern I got is not only from this sheet, is the control. I mean, you've mentioned a lot of EPA regulations and EPA. How should we be assured that will happen?
That will meet the permit conditions?
That you'll meet all the odor control and all the smell control. Is that going to be available for anybody just to look at it, or is it just going to be by you saying so to the board or the health department be involved or EPA involved? Or how can we make sure that the number of permitting that you quoted, and I'm not saying it's not right, but people take it away. How can we be assured or sure assist that will be done on a regular basis? And that this, here is the worksheet for today to show that was done, and this is what it was properly in that concept. I'm quite sure.
That's a very good point. Now, you take the air permit as a case in point. We'll receive an air permit with all the requirements for us to operate. In most cases, that will involve tracking emissions with continuous emission monitors. Those monitors are constantly operating. They're not dependent on us directly reporting. They're actually monitored by a third-party firm that will ensure that they're certified monitors, that the results from them are reproducible, and then they'll go into both the US EPA as well as the state government. We're accountable for them because as part of our permit, we have to demonstrate how we do this. We have to certify that we've done it. That data that's available from the state. We make data like that available to the local community upon asking. We have to be accountable because we actually certify and put the go to court and go to jail if we don't meet those requirements. The state doesn't take our word as gospel. They rely on techniques that they can use, that they can control, like the way the instrument is designed and operated, the way we're operating pieces of equipment. We have to track operating data and submit it and make it available. There are a lot of ways for them to make sure that we're accountable for what we're doing, because they will demand it and they will monitor us.
If you do not locate in Page County, what surrounding counties, if any, would you consider?
Well, I think the easiest answer to that is, regardless of where we go in and around this area, it's going to be a benefit to Page County and any county that's involved in poultry production. One of the key criteria is obviously being as close to our fuel source as possible. We'll be paying for the litter as a fuel, but we'll also be transporting it. We want to ensure that our transportation is minimized where possible. So the expectation is it would be in the Shenandoah Valley one way or another, depending on where we're able to put all the criteria together in a way that's going to be to the acceptability of people that finance us, that we can guarantee that we're doing it in a way that's most cost effective for the utility. So it'll be in and around the area.
Has FiberWatt had to deal with shortages of fuel or a complete prolonged disruption of fuel due to disease, such as an avian flu outbreak?
Excellent question. No, we haven't. But there's aspects of our plan that are specifically built to account for that. First off, if we had to, in most cases, we could probably operate solely on secondary biomass, facility biomass, if it actually came to a point where you couldn't get that supply. Realistically, we locate or site our plant and rely on the supply from a number of areas. One of the reasons why we're not going to be built and solely reliant on just Page County litter is for that exact reason. So we always have access to litter from a lot of different areas. What we were able to demonstrate in the UK is even when there was a disease outbreak, not associated with poultry, but nonetheless, I think it was hook and mouth in the UK, we were really the only agricultural establishment that was able to move in and out of those areas because of the type of biosecurity practices we followed, the truck washing. In fact, I think in the UK they modeled practices that we utilize as demonstrating that they consider to be proper biosecurity. So we do account for that in sight. That's a key criteria to make sure that we always have adequate availability to supply.
Yes, sir. In respect to your negotiations with Dominion Power, they're just a buyer of electricity from the grid, Allegheny Power Generators. And can you give me a estimate of their cost versus your cost of generating kilowatts of electricity?
One of the key criteria, as you can imagine, and I know one of the questions asked, well, why would you build a plant like this? Why not just build a solar park? They're not as cheap currently as coal or natural gas. We do produce power at a slightly higher cost. But in most cases, it's not a huge amount in and above the typical market price. I don't think we've done studies here enough to know what they call their avoided costs. So if they buy from us, in a sense, what costs they're avoiding that they would have on themselves. In North Carolina, and I like to use this example because I think the state recognized that every state has their own portfolio of renewables, and renewables are of high importance. They recognize, much like I think Virginia recognizes, that biomass is probably going to be typically the dominant type of renewable in the Southeast. And the reason for that is you can do wind, you can do solar, but these aren't the best places for wind and solar. In most cases, to do a wind project, you'd be doing ridgeline wind projects. Those aren't always favorably looked at. Solar projects typically cost at least twice, if not more, per kilowatt hour as a biomass plant. In Minnesota, the price that we're selling to the grid is in the neighborhood of 8 to 9 cents per kilowatt hour. And for a renewable, that's a very cost-effective renewable price, market price. That price here in Virginia is going to be dictated by the amount of emission control equipment we have to put in, how far we have to go for litter, probably more than anything, the size of the plant. It is easier to produce cheaper power with larger plants. That's why a coal plant, even if coal's expensive, can be done so cheaper. We're building 1,000 megawatt plants instead of 50 megawatt plants.
I do realize everybody likes to think green, and that's great. But when it comes down to the bottom line, everybody likes to get to purchase something as cheaply as they can. And what's the chance of that cost being passed back on the consumer from the main side?
Like
I do for your slightly higher cost.
Yeah, you have to look at it. And again, I don't know enough about the overall energy market here. In North Carolina, which is ultimately going to rely potentially on three projects rather than one, the basic impact that we would be supplying roughly at startup about 0.12% or 0.12% of all the electricity generated in the state. We would be at a slightly marginally higher price. I mean, it probably works out into quarters per month. It is potentially, when I say potentially, it's potentially now. If the EPA or the Congress were to enact a renewable portfolio standard or cap and trade greenhouse gas issues, the cost of those fossil fuels would go up pretty high, and we'd be even more competitive. And I think many people envision that a renewable like ours over the life of it would be significantly cheaper than a fossil fuel.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
you. What is your site location now as far as topography and geographic topography compared to the Page County, Shawnee Valley area?
Let me go through our four projects in U.S. Three of them have been built, but I'll kind of give you an overview of it. In Minnesota, it's flat. That's probably not a big surprise. It's very flat. Our three projects in North Carolina, we have a project site in Sampson County, North Carolina, that Greg is from. That's also fairly flat. It's flat property. Montgomery County is our other project, and it would be characterized as small rolling hills. I think from a topographic perspective, it's probably from one part of the site to another, it could be anywhere from 50 to 100 feet. In the third project, Surry County, depending how you lay out the project, and that's, I think, one of the key criteria. We look at the site and make sure that we try to impact and have to move as little dirt as possible. But in Surry County, from one end of the project to the other is easily 100 to 150 feet in elevation change. We would actually be up on the upper part of it, but it can be built to the topography.
Okay, would you agree or disagree that the air route throughout the Channel Valley would be more challenging than the site you're presently looking at?
It could very well be, yeah. For us to successfully, and the reality is that indirectly, you would say benefits to the community. The fact that we would have to meet very strict air quality requirements because of, say, the Shenandoah National Park, as well as the fact that we have mountains around it. It's going to meet those criteria. We would have to demonstrate that we're using not only the best available control technology, but any place that would impact, it would meet those very tight criteria. So yeah, it would be a little more challenging there.
Okay. As a representative of our community, I'm very concerned about, for example, you had startup challenges in your Minnesota operation. With that photography being challenged here in this area, I would think you'd also be experiencing things too in startup because it's a new dimension that you're working with. So I want to make sure that that is a total concern of your firm's outfit. With that being said, your job retention at your current facility, what's the rate of turnover and employment?
We had some turnover early on in the project. I think in the last year of our 35 employees, we've had two or three people that have moved on to other jobs. In one case, it involved someone whose spouse was moving to another job. So initially, it wasn't the greatest. Now that we have concentrated on the local labor force, the job retention is extremely high.
I was looking over our questions here, and I don't know if you covered it. We've got too many that we went through.
I
guess one stands out here to me. It says, what states have banned 501 operations?
Actually, you'll probably see reported that Delaware has banned 501, which actually isn't true. The state of Delaware has had a longstanding prohibition against the use of combustion for the supply of power. I mean, it originally came into existence to deal with the fact that they did not want garbage waste energy plants. The question came up as projects were being considered on the Maryland Eastern Shore whether that ban would apply to a fiberglass plant. That existing ban would. So in a sense, the ban would prohibit us from developing, but it wasn't done to prohibit fiberglass from coming here. If you look at the ban itself, it actually says the use of poultry litter to, burning poultry litter is acceptable, but only at the local farm or at a farm located amongst a couple farms. So in a way, it's not a fiberglass ban. It's just an inherent aspect of the state itself.
Does 501 use the railroad in any way whatsoever? The railway?
Railway. Not really. Our site in Benson is actually at a major intersection, a rail that goes from Minneapolis-St. Paul either out to Wyoming or into Colorado. And originally we thought it would be attractive to have a rail siding there. For grinning litter, we do think that there would be some value of doing what we think will likely happen here is moving the nutrients out of the area. So I can see rail traffic as being beneficial for the marketing and movement of the poultry ash fertilizer product. But it just the issue is this is a marginal cost material. That a lot of the cost of that is locked up in transportation. If you move that litter from the barn, you can't, a barn's not going to be next to the rail, so you're going to have to transfer it in a truck somewhere. Then you'd have to load the rail, and then you'd have to move it and unload it. And the more times that you have to move and unload and unload the material, the more costly it becomes. So I don't think from litter, that would be, a prime mover of litter. Now, having rail access can be very attractive to the company that constructed the plant, but they can actually move some of their equipment by rail rather than by truck.
Very much. Thank you.
One other question I have, sir, is with the amount of dust and everything associated with the chicken litter, I'm sure you have a built-in fire suppression system with any of
it. Yes. You know, yes and no. The funny thing is, poultry litter is not a very combustible material. But what we will have, as we have in our Minnesota plant, is a full firewood evaporator plant. We also work with local emergency providers. We have training at our Minnesota plant. Because we're an industrial facility, and the fire company often doesn't have an opportunity to train in settings like that. They tend to use a plant like ours for training purposes. In most cases, litter is not, as I said, the great fuel. Once you get it into the boiler, it burns fine. But it doesn't typically light off as, say, heat dust or material like that. But we do have fire protection.
Okay.
And in our Minnesota plant, we have a diesel fire pump that will manage the water requirements. If you might notice in here, we have a raw water tank. That raw water tank is really about 10 to 15% of it is the water we use, and the rest is actually fire water.
That's what that fire pump and the reserve for those. If you pick Pace County to build a plant, and if Pace County picks you to come, what kind of investment are we looking at? Are you looking at this team?
Our project in Minnesota was a $202 million project. The capital cost for that was probably about $150 million. I think our expectations is a plant, 10 years later, cost of steel, cost of labor and the like, will be upwards easily of $200 million for just the capital cost. So it is a very sizable capital investment in an area. These are not small plants, from a capital perspective. Just to give you kind of an added, I don't know the trucking company, what their investment was. I believe the trucking firm invested $2 million in their truck maintenance facility. The fertilizer plant was $2 million. So those are spin-off capital investments in addition to the capital we put on the ground.
I would like to thank you for your presentation. And we actually thank Tiger Watt. And beyond, before we close, I got one gentleman I'd like to ask his opinion on and put him on the spot. Mr. Burson, he's with the Virginia Department of Agriculture. He's in the back. I'm going to put him on the spot. I'm not, because I told him at the beginning I was going to. Is there any information, sir? I know we've heard Fiberwatt here, and we've heard their analysis of the generation of fertilizer for farmers to be used. And any information that you think would benefit the board at this time? I know I'm directly on the spot. I apologize for that.
Well,
thank you for the opportunity. I wasn't really prepared to address anyone, but in terms of one thing I think I can give a little input on is where Fiberwatt sits in the area of renewable energy, particularly manure energy. That's an area that I've been working with for about a year and a half, and we've looked at a number of different technologies that are out there. There's pyrolysis, there's gasification, there's digestion, a lot of different ways to use manure to create energy. And all have promise, but none, to my knowledge, are anywhere near commercially viable scale that Fiberwatt is, more of the commercially proven. They've got their facility with 500,000 to 600,000 tons a year of litter. To my knowledge, there is no other facility like that available. Yes. They provide a real solution right now.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for the
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Before we close, is there any supervisor would like to have a comment before we close?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. One more question for Mr. Walmsley. Are there any other facts or figures you can give us in order to us for us to form an opinion on the viability of your plant located in Page County? Anything else? Anything you left out that you need to give us?
There's plenty of information additionally that can be supplied. I think one of the best things that you can do is not so much talk to us on facts and figures. Talk to the people in Benson, Minnesota that have gone through the same process, rationalize why they wanted a project sited in their area. Talk about the benefits from, I know one of the issues that often comes with a project like this, property value. Now, how will this affect property value? They've seen in that community, unlike all the other communities, population stability, new homes being built are as close costly and they're as close to the plan as possible. So you can gain a lot more from a community that's gone through it and what it meant to them than I can offer. I can offer quite a bit more, and it will.
Where it's actually going to, we have three in North Carolina that are putting contact with you.
Then I would like to make a comment to the folks that are here from District 3, which is the district I represent, and I think the proposed site that you might be looking at, one of them, which is where the Project Clover site is. You folks deserve to know, since you've taken your time to come out, I think at this juncture you deserve to know where we stand, and I'm going to at least let you know where I stand this very evening. I used this example a couple of times this week. If the voters in District 3 and I were going out for ice cream, and all of you want vanilla and I want chocolate, and you send me up to the window to order, I'm going to have to order vanilla. That being said, I don't know that I can support this chocolate. Due respect, sir, I don't want to jump the gun here, but I'm letting the constituents that I represent, I'm their voice, and they deserve to know where I stand. So now you know.
I'd like to thank the citizens of the county to come, everybody came, and also I really, really thank you for your respect you've given tonight, and I thank Fiberwatch for the presentation, and I thank everybody for coming. Jeff, you got a question or a comment?
I just got some comments. I want to commend the community for their involvement tonight, coming out, get here a little bit next to 10, and I'm real proud to see this, because to me this is a major decision which this county is faced with, and we want to reassure that the citizens that this board, me being new to the board, is going to make the most logical decisions for our community. And we've got a lot of great things here in the valley that we are committed to protect, and to me that's the utmost importance. It's our lifestyle that's here, and some articles about how's John communicated. Naysayers or implants or whatever. We are a community of Page County. We come here, right? There you go. That's good. So anyhow, all I want to say is we're a community that is united together, and we desperately need jobs, but we don't need jobs at the sacrifice of the quality of our life, our lifestyle. Responsibility to do a total evaluation because we've got three new board members on here, and we don't want to demean anything that's went on in the past, but that's, as we say in layman's terms, that's word over the dam, and we have a future ahead of us that we got to look at. We want to make sure the quality of jobs and operations we bring to this community are positive. And technology is changing daily, and we have to keep up with it, but we have to also incorporate that within the lifestyle of which all the folks here, whether you've moved here, you've been here all your life, want to be a part of our community. And with that being said, I want to thank this group for their presentation tonight. It was very broad. I don't want the county to waste any what I call soft costs that is unnecessary. I think it's real important that if we're going to make a decision on this, we want to gather data like this, but it's extremely important to all of our constituents here that we get and see the kind of support, whether it's for or against, that gives us an indication of the direction that we need to go. And it's our responsibility to support the majority of what Pace County wants. Thank you for your time.
Interest in this, and when I first started to run for district board supervisor, my platform was agriculture and tourism, and drawing on what the potential of Pace County is and what we have here, and not what the assets we do have here, and I believe that's the vision to me of Pace County, and I can't support this business coming in.
What I would like to do, and this is an informational meeting tonight. I want to come in here with an open mind and hear, because a lot of things have said, it's the first time I've heard them said. And I want to look at all the facts. I want to go to Benson, and I want to talk to the people on the street and see what they have to say. I want to put my nose next to that damn smokestack, and I want to see what's coming out. I'm not going to say I'm against the project here in the first stages. I want to keep open mind, but I want to hear what the people's experiencing already are saying. And it's nobody that's going to happen without me going up there. And I'm going to Benson, Minnesota.
Again, thank you, and the meeting is adjourned.
Jim Curry, I'm going to go right now.